So I will continue to follow the theme of establishing asymmetries, and the type of asymmetries I will be talking about are twofold. At the beginning, I will tell you about establishing asymmetry within a single cell, in the Drosophila egg cell or early embryo, and then most of my talk I'll be telling you more about establishing asymmetries with which make different cells different. We could say mother daughters or stem cells different from their progeny. And so you don't think everything is polar. There is, you will find that there is some symmetry to my talk. We come back in a number of points to the talk from Judith Kimball earlier today, on the one hand in terms of the questions and to some extent also in terms of the molecules I'll be discussing. So in the first slide, I'll be starting with Drosophila embryogenesis and during oogenesis, maternal messages and proteins are synthesized and they become localized, some of them in the oocyte, and then within the oocyte they become sorted. And one of these RNAs which becomes sorted in the oocyte and later on is localized in the early embryo is Nana's RNA. So Nana's RNA, the majority of the RNA is localized to the posterior pole, and some of the RNA is uniformly distributed. As Liz Gavis, when she was in my lab, showed is that only the localized RNA is translated, which creates a protein gradient in the early Drosophila syncytium such that Nana's protein levels are highest at the posterior pole and tether off towards the anterior pole. Nana is together with another protein called promelia, which is uniformly distributed at this time, affect the translation of a transcriptional repressor called hunchback. Hunchback is synthesized not only maternally but also by the zygote, but it's only the maternal component that is affected by Nana's and hunchback and promelia. Hunchback RNA is uniformly distributed, but through the action of Nana's and promelia, hunchback is only translated in the anterior region where Nana's is absent, so leaving an anterior to posterior gradient in the syncytial embryo. Absence of hunchback in this region creates a boundary which will define where the abdomen can form. Thus, in a Nana's or promelia mutant embryo, there will be no Nana's function, hunchback will be translated throughout, and the embryo will not form an abdomen. Robin Wharton identified in the hunchback 3' UTR the sequences which are responsible for Nana's and promelia regulation, and he termed them Nana's response elements. These sequences are bipartite and are repeated. And these sequences do actually share, although only slight, similarity to the sequences that Judith showed in the FEM3 RNA. So in a Nana's and promelia mutant, of course, the sites, and I will tell you more about, are not occupied by promelia, which binds to these sites, and thus we get an embryo which lacks the abdomen. Similarly, when these sites are deleted or when we have introduced point mutations which mutate every G residue in this repeat region, we get the same kind of phenotype, that is that hunchback is now not any longer translationally regulated and again abdomen formation is repressed. So promelia and Nana's act together to repress translation through these NRE sequences, and data from Robin Wharton's lab indicated that it is the promelia protein which binds specifically to the NRE sequences. Nana's, on the other hand, which provides the spatial information to the translational regulation, despite looking to some extent like an RNA binding protein, having two zinc fingers and binding RNA, which actually relatively good affinity, doesn't have any specificity to these NRE sequences. So we think that these two proteins are interacting with each other. So when we cloned the promelia protein, we felt probably similar to a number of people who are talking about those large things which are just awful to work with. So promelia encodes 165 kilodalton protein, and it actually stretches over more than 100 kilobases of sequence. It has an intron, a giant intron in the middle of the gene. However, when Doug Barker looked at the sequence of promelia, what he found was that there was a repeated structure at the C-terminus with 8 repeats, each of about 30 amino acids. And what we have done now, and this is work by Phil Seymour, who's a postdoc in my lab but stayed in Boston when we moved to New York, and he's now working in Jamie Williamson's lab in a very fruitful collaboration between trying to bridge structural biology and developmental biology. So what Phil did was to find out which part of the Pumilia protein is actually the RNA binding protein. And so he made various portions of this Pumilia protein and asked whether any of these portions could bind the nanos response element sequences. And he found that only the C-terminus, which contains these repeats, can bind the RNA sequences. And this is shown here in a gel shift assay where Phil is using different concentrations of the Pumilia protein, and he binds them to the NRE sequences, or actually a sequence which contains the NRE. It spans over the NRE. It's about 140 nucleotides. And what he can show is that there is very good specificity and good affinity. So affinity is in about the 10 kilo Dalton, 10 nanomolar range. And when he looks at the specificity by looking at the binding of this protein to the mutant NRE, what he finds is that he has to use about 10 times more protein to find a similar shift. So there is a good affinity and there's specificity for the NRE sequences. He then wanted to know whether it is indeed this repeat structure, and so he started to make deletions. So this is the one I showed you just before. We started to delete into this repeat structure. One idea was that maybe each repeat was binding a separate NRE. But this is clearly not the case, because even flanking regions, if we just put an insertion in a flanking region, we abolish completely RNA binding activity. And so this indicates that this the repeat domain is itself a novel RNA binding domain. And this RNA binding domain is conserved. And this is just some of the conservations that we have found out of the database. And here's Pumilia. And what we found when we were comparing actually Pumilia to similar ESTs that are present in the database was that there is a human homolog, which is actually very similar to the Drosophila protein. And so we were curious if this human homolog could bind to the same sequences. And this is shown here. So Phil has made not only a GST fusion of the binding domain, but also he has just expressed this binding domain alone. And what he finds, and this is now the GST fusion actually, which is shown, what he found, again, similar affinity to the hunchback NRE sequences, and also again the binding is specific. And so we conclude that presumably Pumilia is fulfilling somehow a similar function in with this human protein and in human cells. It's not really clear what the function of this, these human proteins are at this point. So I would like to just summarize this part of my talk. Number of experiments indicate that Pumilia can bind to the RNA independent of nanos function. And so we could imagine in the anterior part of the embryo where hunchback is translated, Pumilia may actually be bound, because we do our binding experiments in the absence of nanos. Pumilia may actually be bound to these NREs. But it's not effective, so the hunchback can still be translated. Only in the posterior region where nanos is also present, translation would be repressed. And recent results from the Strickland labs indicate that presumably polyadenylation is affected such that the polyA tail of hunchback is shortened. And experiments from my lab carried out by Charlotte Wong indicated that translation is indeed affected through initiation. Various epistatic experiments that we have done indicate that we can't order nanos and Pumilia at this point, so we really think they act as a complex, although we haven't shown that it is a biochemical complex. So I would like to now turn to another part of my talk, and that is sort of more cellular asymmetries. Nanos is not restricted in its function to early embryogenesis. Nanos protein, indeed, is taken up in the pole cells and then stays in the pole cells while they're migrating and eventually meet the mesoderm and then become incorporated into the gonads. And we tried to understand, to see whether actually nanos protein in these germ cells is important for germ cell development. And this is not a trivial experiment, because nanos mutants from which lack the protein do not make a normal embryo, and so if the morphology of the embryo is already changed, then it is very difficult to see whether the germ cells can actually mutate. And what we did to circumvent this problem was we eliminated hunchback, the maternal hunchback, and by eliminating maternal hunchback, the repressor is eliminated and a normal abdomen can form as long as zygotic hunchback is present. And now we can ask how the germ cells are migrating. And just to summarize these data, what we find is that early on already, germ cells will not attach to the mesoderm normally. However, some germ cells will make it into the gonad. But irrespective whether there is a zygotic copy of nanos provided by the sperm or not, we never find any germline either in the male or in the female. And if you would like to know more about this role of nanos during early germ cell migration and germ cell behavior, I would like to recommend you to listen to Satoru Kobayashi's talk later in the symposium. Clearly nanos is required for the early stages of germ cell migration, presumably, and germ cell survival, but it is also re-expressed later on. And so now I have to introduce to you oogenesis. So oogenesis starts with the interaction between somatic cells, which are called terminal filament cells, and the germline stem cell. And this is basically the pole cells will give rise to these germline stem cells. So the cells I showed you migrating will give rise to these germline stem cells. The germline stem cell rejuvenates itself and gives rise to a cystoblast. The cystoblast divides through four rounds, giving rise to 16 cells. One of these cells will give rise to the oocyte. All of these cells are connected. So when we looked first at this, and now I should also tell you what happens later during oogenesis. Once the oocyte is determined, and these are the 15 other cells which become nerve cells, the whole cluster is surrounded by somatic cells. The oocyte then differentiates and grows inside, while the nerve cells provide a lot of the products which are required, again, to make a new germplasm, a new location where nanos is localized. And basically, the cycle of germ cell development starts again. Nanos protein is expressed in the stem cells and in the cystoblast cells. So in the early, in these very early stages. And this is now the expression of the protein produced zygotically. So this means by the genomic copy. So this is not the purulence of the maternal product that I was talking about earlier, which is already present in the germ cells that is inherited from the mother. And we had observed once we looked at strong alleles of nanos that they do not form many embryos and do not make many eggs. And now we have looked also at pumilio, since we would like to know whether the two proteins are also acting at this stage in a similar manner. And again, we find that pumilio mutants produce very few eggs, and that pumilio protein is expressed in the stem cells. And these are experiments carried out by Zandy Forbes in my lab. So we wanted to know what the phenotype was of nanos and pumilio in more detail. And we also wanted to know if nanos and pumilio, it looks like they are expressed in the germline, whether they're actually required to function in the germline. And this is just a summary of the phenotype of nanos of homozygous mutant females. So this is a wild type ovarial. So this is one part of many growing egg chambers. So this is where the stem cells divide, and this is where the nerve cells and the oocyte are surrounded by somatic cells, and they continue to grow. And what you can see, nanos mutants do not actually produce any germline. Or let's say most of them, 50% of them never show a germline at birth of the female, at hatching of the female. Sometimes we see germ cells develop, and they will usually immediately differentiate into an egg, so we never see the chains which are produced by continuously producing stem cells at the tip. So the nanos phenotype is a depletion of the stem cells, and thus stem cell fate cannot be maintained. We wanted to know whether this phenotype was germline dependent or soma dependent, because the maintenance of stem cells, as has been suggested by experiments by Hyphen Lin and Alan Spradling, requires the collaboration between the stem cells and the terminal filament cells. And so to test this, what Zandy did is she transplanted wild-type pole cells into a mutant nanos mother. If it was only the germline, then the phenotype should be rescued. However, if the nanosoma, the mutant nanosoma of these flies had a function, then we would not expect a rescue of the phenotype. And what we find is that the phenotype is rescued completely, and what was very interesting was that just transplanting one or two pole cells will lead to the complete population of the germline with germline cells. And so this means that the nanos mutant pole cells were actually not able to compete with the wild-type germ cells which were introduced. A similar experiment we did with Pumilio, which also to test whether it is necessary, its function is necessary in the germline. So Pumilio, strong Pumilio mutants have the same phenotype as strong mutants in nanos, and that is that the germline is not maintained. Very rarely in early flies we see maybe one germline cyst, and then in later flies we don't see any. In this case we use the cDNA which encodes the Pumilio protein, which was driven by the nanos promoter, which we know now is germline specific. And so we find complete rescue, indicating or suggesting very strongly that also Pumilio acts in the same cells as nanos does and has the same phenotype. So I would like to now turn to my last part of my talk, and that is what I've told you so far, is that we have a stem cell and that the stem cells, maintenance of the stem cell requires nanos function, and that then the stem cell provides a sister blast which goes through four rounds of division, making 16 cells, and one cell becomes different. Why does this one cell become different? The reason why this one cell becomes different is that there are genes which affect and are asymmetrically localized to the single cell. And one of these genes are the egalitarian gene. What happens in egalitarian mutants, while the early divisions are completely normal, and so a 16-cell cyst is formed, which has the normal connections between the cells, so all the 16 cells are connected. However, the oocyte is not determined. Jen Mach, a former graduate student in my lab, cloned the egalitarian gene, and she first characterized the phenotype in detail and found that indeed, in egalitarian mutants, instead of having a normal ovarial where you see the polyploid nerve cells and the oocyte growing, all 16 cells become polyploid nerve cells and an oocyte is never formed. When she looked at the expression of egalitarian, she found that egalitarian is already expressed very early on. Pretty much when the 16-cell cyst is formed, we start to see sometimes more egalitarian protein, which is here in red, while the DNA is stained in green. We see more egalitarian protein in two products. Once the cyst is completely formed and encased by the somatic follicle cells, egalitarian is strictly localized to the future oocyte. Egalitarian indeed is localized to the posterior pole of the future oocyte, as we can see by the oocyte nucleus, which marks here sort of in the middle position towards the posterior end. This posterior localization of egalitarian persists until stage 7 or 8 of oogenesis, when we know there is a rearrangement of the microtubules. So up till now, the microtubule organizing center is oriented towards the posterior pole, and so egalitarian localizes with the microtubule organizing center. Then between stage 7 and stage 9, the microtubules reorganize such that the microtubule organizing center at the posterior is released, and new microtubules are now generated and extending from the anterior pole. Concomitant with this, egalitarian distribution is also changed, and now egalitarian is at the anterior pole. So egalitarian basically marks the microtubule organizing center, and I'll get back to that and its role in stabilizing the center. Egalitarian has an identical phenotype and identical localization pattern to another gene which was previously identified and characterized by Robin Wharton, Gary Struhl, and Bayat Suter and Ruth Stewart. And BICD localization looks identical to that of egalitarian, first being at the posterior and then associating at the anterior pole. Since these two genes have similar phenotypes, we thought maybe these genes actually form a complex, and so Jen did immunoprecipitation experiments and showed that with an egalitarian antibody, she can immunoprecipitate egalitarian and can co-immunoprecipitate big D. Similar with a big D antibody, she can immunoprecipitate big D and co-IP egalitarian. So clearly these two proteins are part of a complex. What does this complex do, and how is complex formation related to the localization of the two proteins to the oocyte and oocyte determination? And for this, Jen analyzed mutant alleles in egalitarian and in big D. First of all, she showed that there's a number of egalitarian alleles are protein nulls, and again, egalitarian is in red here, and green is DNA, and so in this null allele there is no egalitarian protein present, and in this allele, big D is uniformly distributed. It does not get into a single cell. Similar in this egalitarian allele, which does make egalitarian protein, however, it has a new single amino acid change. This change makes this protein, which is normally expressed normal levels, unable to co-RP big D. And as a consequence, egalitarian is uniformly distributed and big D is uniformly distributed. So this tells us that complex formation is probably important for the localization of these two proteins. However, it's not just complex formation, because this allele of big D, which is uniformly distributed, big D protein is uniformly distributed. However, this mutant protein is still able to co-IP egalitarian. However, egalitarian is uniformly distributed as well, clearly showing that localization, complex formation alone is not sufficient for the localization. Finally, this allele of big D, in which big D and egalitarian both localize to a single cell, and both proteins still forming a complex, tells us something very important about egalitarian function, because now the wild-type egalitarian is in a single cell. However, an oocyte is not determined. So just complex formation and localization of egalitarian is not sufficient to make an oocyte, to determine an oocyte. So there have to be additional factors which are required for oocyte determination. So, as I said, this complex of egalitarian and big D co-localizes with the microtubule organizing center. And Bill Turkoff had shown that when he disrupts, that in egalitarian mutants and in big D mutants, the microtubule organizing center is not maintained. And that in big D mutants, it is actually not established at all. And in egalitarian mutants, it is never maintained. So it's initially there is an asymmetry, but then this asymmetry is not maintained, indicating that these two proteins have a role to stabilize the microtubule network. We think that this interaction between the microtubules and egalitarian goes in both directions, because if we look at drugs which affect the microtubule network and we look at the egalitarian localization, we can show that while egalitarian normally is localized to the posterior pole, if we disrupt the microtubules with colchicine treatment, egalitarian and big D, as was shown by Bill Turkoff, are no longer localized. So this indicates that on the one hand, localization of these factors requires the microtubules, and on the other hand, microtubules are required for the localization of the factors, and microtubule stability requires those factors. So to test this hypothesis further, we asked whether when the rearrangement of the microtubules occurs during oogenesis, whether that is affected by the same genes that we know which are responsible for this repolarization of the microtubule network. And one of the genes which is very important in this is Gorkin, and you'll hear later in the symposium from Tudy Schupper about Gorkin function. Gorkin encodes a TGF-alpha molecule, which is synthesized in the oocyte, and Gorkin function in the oocyte to affect the fate of the follicle cells. And the receptor of Gorkin is located in the follicle cells. It's the Drosophila EGF receptor or a torpedo. And activation of this receptor in the posterior region of the follicle cells leads to a signal back into the oocyte, which then seems to be required or the necessary prerequisite for the repolarization of the microtubule network. And as a consequence of the repolarization of the microtubule network, the polarization of the oocyte, which later leads to the polarization of the embryo, occurs. So there are three consequences of this microtubule, or at least three consequences. One is the sorting of RNAs. Bicoid RNA becomes localized to the anterior pole, and Oscar RNA becomes localized to the posterior pole. Localization of these two RNAs basically establishes anterior-posterior polarity of the embryo. Further, the oocyte nucleus moves from its posterior position prior to Gorkin's signal to an anterior position. And as you will hear much more from Trudy's lab, this movement of the oocyte nucleus and getting Gorkin to this site around the oocyte nucleus will actually lead to the establishment of dorsoventral polarity. And this conclusions were first drawn by Gonzalez Reckers in Daniel St. Johnson's lab and Siegfried Roth in Trudy Schubach's lab. So what we asked in the last experiment I would like to show you is, in a Gorkin mutant where the repolarization of the microtubule network doesn't occur, what happens to the egalitarian Big D complex? And that's shown here. And what you can see is, early on, egalitarian is located at the posterior pole, and it remains at the posterior pole, as does the oocyte nucleus. So clearly, egalitarian again follows the orientation of the microtubules and stays where the microtubule organizing center is. So we have two hypotheses to explain what egalitarian does. Establishing microtubule asymmetry and making a microtubule organizing center, a stable microtubule organizing center, as I just indicated, is a prerequisite for localizing RNAs and proteins and sorting them within the egg cell, which then will basically pre-pattern the oocyte and thus tell the embryo where to make a head and where to make a tail. If there is no oocyte, of course, this cannot occur, and egalitarian and Big D, by establishing, making an oocyte, they're clearly playing a role in getting the RNAs into the oocyte, which later have to be sorted. By stabilizing the microtubule network within the oocyte, they're also allowing the signaling to occur that is necessary to firmly anchor RNAs to the anterior and posterior pole. But at this point, we don't really know if egalitarian and Big D are involved in directly transporting the RNA to the microtubule organizing center, or whether through a role in stabilizing the microtubule organizing center, then the RNAs can get sorted, and further experiments need to be done to distinguish between these two hypotheses. So at the very end, I would like to just sort of tell you, because I told you a lot of different facets of establishing asymmetry during Drosophila embryogenesis, I want to just summarize some of the main points, since the ringer hasn't gone off yet. What I started off with is really telling you something about body axis formation. I told you that nanos and familial act together to establish the asymmetry of the body axis by determining where the abdomen forms through the translational regulation of hunchback. I then told you that the nanos function is not limited to its role in establishing body axis, but that nanos, which is localized to the pole plasm, and then once it has fulfilled its function in body axis formation, the protein is taken up into the pole cells. The protein actually plays a very important role in the pole cells itself. It is actually important that these pole cells develop into functional germ cells, because the germ cells do not behave right, they cannot migrate right, and germ cells which lack nanos protein will never be able to populate the gonad, and so no testis, no functional testis or ovary can be formed. Nanos is also expressed again zygotically by the germline stem cell, and again it is required there for the maintenance of the stem cells, and no stem cells are maintained in the absence of nanos or pumilio. And we think that in all these cases, nanos and pumilio are acting together, and they're acting germline dependent. Nanos is then required to set up the stem cell so that the stem cell can divide and give rise to the egg chamber. And I showed you that egalitarian is important to establish the asymmetry of the egg, which leads back to the same cycle. And I would like to thank the people in my lab who conducted these experiments. So the first set of experiments that I told you about, pumilio being a specific RNA binding protein, were carried out by Phil Seymour, in a very fruitful collaboration with Jamie Williamson's lab at MIT. And Zandy Forbes did all the experiments with the phenotype of nanos in the germline. And all the experiments I told you about egalitarian were carried out by Jen Ma. Thank you very much.